I haven't finished eating yet, but in the interest of acting now, which apparently is what the Hong Kong government tells us to do, we'll start early, hopefully more effectively acting now than they're going to be. Our subject today, as you know, is South Korea's transformation, a new global power. The great omnipotence of the FCC has come into force here, because this was arranged some time ago, but of course we knew that Korea was going to be a hot topic. And our speaker has kindly agreed that he's going to go further than the remit of the title suggests in talking about the current situation between the North and the South, as well as the bulk of his topic. But before we get to that, and before I introduce him, let me just tell you, as ever, we have a very packed program of speaker lunches. In fact, we have another one tomorrow with Stephen King from HSBC on the subject of losing control, the emerging threats to Western prosperity, a subject that I think will interest a lot of our members. On the Thursday, we have Robert Sutter talking about China's rise in Asian and world affairs. And looking forward to the 21st of this month, we have Simon Young on the subject of electing Hong Kong's chief executive in 2012, which, as you know, is slightly in the news at the moment. Our speaker today is somebody who, when you hear about Korea, his name comes up. This is sort of Mr. Go-To for things about Korea, so we're very fortunate to have him here. I also note that he's a reformed academic. There's many of our colleagues in the world of journalism are heading towards academia. He's headed the other way, which shows what an entirely sensible man he is, and has headed away from academia into the world of journalism. Whether that's financially wise or not, I don't know. But the fact of the matter is that he is, outside Korea, one of the best informed people on the subject. He's visiting Hong Kong just for a week, and we are very fortunate to have him here today. So please welcome Aidan Foster Carter.
Thank you very much, Stephen, for that kind introduction, and good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. It's a great... Can you hear me? Good. It's a great pleasure and privilege to be in these hallowed halls. Can I, in best North Korean style, talk about myself? But only to begin with. I don't think mine is a particularly famous name. The introduction was very kind. Partly because when you work, as I do, as a country analyst, which I suppose is sort of somewhere midway between journalism and the academy, there is such a thing as property, and most of the people that I write for, and let me name them and thank them, they include the Economist Intelligence Unit, Oxford Analytica, and most recently Jane's, and anyone else will pay me, basically, your name doesn't usually appear. And I'm not particularly a diva, but this is just the sort of circumstances. And every now and then you get an op-ed, the FT are kind to me, and so forth. But I started out in this. I mean, this is, I have to thank this city. Once upon a time, there was a journal called the Far Eastern Economic Review. And once upon a time, in the year of 1984, appropriately for North Korea, there was a young academic who was getting interested and trying to puzzle it all out, and wrote an incredibly long and turgid article, well over 2,000 words, under the title, which I think was my own, Reading the Entrails of the Pyongyang Goat. Derek Davis published it in the Far Eastern Economic Review with a very rare misprint in the title. It actually said Reading the Entails. But I forgive him. And 2 years later, when I got my first trip to North Korea, he was generous on a scale that I think doesn't happen anymore, does it? I got a cover story with about 8 different articles in it. I got several articles after that and a subsidy for the trip. God bless Derek Davis. God bless the Far Eastern Economic Review. I just wanted to say that. Anyway, in best North Korean style, I have no intention at all of talking about what I said I was going to talk about, because after all, Juche, you know, self-reliance. I shall do exactly as I please. Or more appropriately, as Stephen said, we had planned all this a long way in advance, and of course we knew how interesting Korea would get. I'm going to try and say something about what's going on now, and I'm going to try and say things that you haven't heard before, which of course means there's no guarantee they're going to be true. It is brand new. I'm going to say this in two halves, one about the North and a rather specific aspect of personnel changes, and then one about the South rather more generally. And my revised title would be, What Are the Koreans Playing At? Note the absence of the word North from that. And so I'll say my bold claim. There's no point in coming if one doesn't provoke, after all. I worry that in Seoul, as in Pyongyang, policy confusionism, not Confucianism, confusionism, is leading to wobble and worry. In saying that, I do not for one moment equate the stupidly criminal with the criminally stupid. But I think it is possible, I put to you as a proposition that you can slap back at me if you wish, that both Koreas, unfortunately, are currently led by men who are impulsive tacticians rather than long-term strategists with cool, clear heads. I'll try and make good that claim. But now for North Korea, I'm going to do something very, very specific. We can talk about the Chonan and the ship directly, by all means, in questions. I'm sure you'll want to. But I want to talk about Ri Jae-gang. I'm sure you're all thinking about Ri Jae-gang, aren't you? I'm sure you're all mourning him. And I must have hat-tipped to an old friend, Neil Druitt, who drew my attention to what I hope I would have seen anyway, an article by the New York Times' excellent Choi Sang-hun, North Korea reports the death of an official guiding the succession. And so I went to look. This is sort of the methods that one uses in this game. Obviously, anyone who claims to know about North Korea has often been said is a fool or a liar. One does one's best. It is still reading the entrails. But Ri Jae-gang, look him up on KCNA, which, as I'm sure you know if you follow these things, has been indexed by some friendly chap who is very unofficial in San Francisco, complete with graphics from Team America World Police. So it's wonderful. You can actually, you can look up the North Korean news agency. You can see when people get mentioned, when they don't get mentioned. So Ri Jae-gang, on the 2nd of June, this is very hot news, this, which you don't always get in North Korea, do you? Ri Jae-gang, at the age of 80 or 81, was at a party. And it was one of Kim Jong-il's parties. You don't say no to those. And the entertainment, oh, there was entertainment, was from Korean People's Army Art Squad Unit 963. So here he is. He's on the 1st of June. He's enjoying a classic Pyongyang fun night out with the boss. And I would like to tell you briefly, in quoting directly from KCNA, what went on. I quote, "The squad put on the stage such colorful numbers of diverse genres as female quintet, We Serve the General, male solo and mixed octet, We Will Remain True to the Leadership of the Party, dialogic poem, gigantic footprints for devoted service." You're really sorry that you missed this, aren't you? Oongum, a special North Korean instrument invented by Kim Jong-il, they claim, and female sextet, Bright Moon Over Our Country. Agitation Through Reminiscences. Now, there's a genre we don't get enough of. Comrades, Take This Revolver, Please. Serial of Wartime, Songs My Song in the Trench, To a Decisive Battle and For My Only Motherland, and Chorus, The Road of Victory. So, you know, that was a pretty good night out, fully demonstrating the might of the soldier artists creditably performing their sacred mission as buglers in the Songun era. Okay, that's what he does on June the 1st. On the 3rd of June, remember that previous report was from the 2nd of June, KCNA reports Kim Jong-il as sending a wreath to the beer, not as in what we drink, the B-I-E-R, of Ri Jae-gang. He died in the small hours. Now, North Korea, which as we know never tells you anything, occasionally tells you far more than you expect them to, because not in KCNA, but in the Korean sources, it reveals that he died in a car accident at 1:45 in the morning in Pyongyang, where there aren't any cars. What on earth is going on? And Choi's article speculates as to whether it might have been a car accident, because, you know, for all that there isn't a lot of traffic, somebody was probably drunk, the roads aren't that good, there are no lights, etc., etc. Or was he perhaps bumped off? So I could go on more about him, but I probably won't because it'd be too dull. I did look him up a bit. He mostly seems to have been accompanying Kim Jong-il. The first reference was in 2001 where he heard a song called I Especially Love Pilots. We've all been there, haven't we? And seriously, you can go through KCNA and you can see when he gets mentioned and when he doesn't. And you can see a period of almost 3 years when he only appears once. And so you may reasonably assume, it's not an exact science, this, that he was out of favor. So as a result of this, I slightly disagree with the analysis that a lot of people are getting, saying, which is that Ri Jae-gang and Jang Song-taek, who you possibly have heard of, if you follow this, Jang Song-taek is the brother-in-law, Kim Jong-un's brother-in-law. Most analysts say they are rivals, but it seems they were purged at the same time. So unless Kim Jong-il said, oh, I'm really fed up with you two fighting, you can both bugger off for 3 years, Then I think possibly they were on the same side. So this is it's pathetic in a way. This is sort of the dreadful level at which one tries to piece together what is actually going on. He clearly was an important guy with the succession. The general point that I'm trying to make is that it seems to me there are a number of cases of this kind. Hat tip to a very useful website. Of course, in the age, I actually did this job before the internet existed, and I have no idea how I did it. Does that apply to others of you here? I mean, in terms of the resources, there is now a quite new website called, I suppose it's a blog really, called North Korea Leadership Watch. It's run by a man called Michael Madden, about whom I know nothing really, except I think he's quite young and he's American. He has a wonderful taste for titles. He has an article, a very good one, about the aforesaid Jang Song-taek called The Juche Jump, Hey Mr. Jang. And I thought, well, that's how young people speak nowadays, but I did ask him about it. It's apparently, for the cultural among you, it's a very esoteric reference to a very early Ike and Tina Turner song, so clearly a man of culture. And anyway, he has put together the fact that about 11 of the North Korean gerontocracy have left the scene, either gone to meet their maker, who will probably have something to say to them, or left their jobs in about 6 months. Now, partly because it is a gerontocracy, people just do die off. It's quite astonishing how many of the people who run North Korea are in their 80s. They're still there. Kim Jong-il at 68 or 69, whichever it is actually a mere stripling. I won't go through the list because it would be dull, but I do recommend you go to North Korean Leadership and look it up for yourself. I think there is something going on. The trouble is that I have probably egg on face in a strictly metaphorical sense, because if any of you do know my earlier work, which I partly hope you don't, I have been predicting the collapse of North Korea almost as long as North Korea has existed, which is perhaps slightly unwise. I may have invented the word collapsist, and I agree I was a premature collapsist. I could probably put that in a slightly better way. But I do think that we are in a period of some agitation now. I won't go into detail. I'll leave that to questions. But I put some of it in my article in the Far East Economic Review. I haven't been drinking. The Financial Times a little earlier in the year. It's not wishful thinking. I mean, there are two sorts of wishful thinking about North Korea, aren't there? There are the people who hate it so much and who cannot believe that anywhere so peculiar and nasty exists that they're sure that it will absolutely collapse tomorrow. That is wishful thinking. There is also the other opposite sort of wishful thinking, which is so concerned at the genuinely, I think, heinous and horrendous risks of a collapse, of a likely, I think likely, transition of a non-evolutionary kind, that they insist, I'm tempted to say against all the evidence, but sort of they insist as an axiom, as an a priori, that some sort of a deal is possible, that the North Koreans are, all that banging noise that the North Koreans are usually making of one sort is actually just knocking on the door. And if we listen carefully and try and decode what they're doing, we'll get somewhere. Well, that's wishful thinking too. And it seems to me that whether one is a journalist, an academic, or whatever I am in between, you shouldn't have an a priori position on that. You've just got to keep looking at the situation day by day by day and see what's happening. And on that basis, my heart and my head are, as so often in life, apart. Obviously, we all want a soft landing, don't we? Because who would wish another war on the peninsula, or who would wish the sorts of chaos, which are of various kinds, that a non-soft landing would be? But, if you look at what Kim Jong-il has been doing, and even if you factor in the various mistakes that others have made, which I shall come to probably rather quickly, George Bush, I shall pass over in silence, but Lee Myung-bak, I shan't quite pass over in silence. You can't really, I think, or it's very hard, let somebody do it here if they want to in the questions, to say the North Koreans really are trying to come to terms with the modern world and it's just that other people are making it so difficult for them. I really think, empirically, my judgment is that that's not true. Quite apart from the whole nuclear issue, look at that ridiculous currency redenomination at the end of last year. They did that to themselves. That wasn't about any pressure from the outside. It's just a complete piece of nonsense. Won't go into the details unless you ask me to. Also, a handy excuse to confiscate the sort of the emergent petty bourgeoisie's meager savings and so on. So my judgment that it is, I fear that it is going to be messy, is not based on any wish that it be so, but simply that as far as I can see, neither in the field of economic reform nor in the field of sort of peace and with the rest of the world, is North Korea actually going down that route. But let me now turn to the South Koreans. Have I got about 5 minutes, something of that sort? Because I obviously want to leave it to you. What are they up to? What on earth is going on? Now, again, no equivalence. The Chonan was a very, very nasty crime indeed, and I am certainly not one of those who doubts for a moment that the North Koreans did it, but there are plenty who do, and we can indeed talk about that as well. But look at the extraordinary different ways that they've played it. First of all, Friday night, the ship goes up. Everybody's asleep, probably. As we now know, South Korean ministers sort of get woken up, rushed off to the war room, that sort of thing, but they didn't tell us at the time. And, you know, very briefly, I got rushed into a BBC studio and so forth. And then immediately, the South Koreans said, that's all right, no, we don't really know, accident and so forth. Very clever. Because obviously you don't want to start a second Korean War, and you genuinely don't quite know what's happened, except that your ship has just blown in two. And also, South Korea being a very important, and nowadays a rather more open economy than it used to be, you really don't want to frighten the markets. Wall Street was still open at that time, the Won and the Dow Jones itself very briefly dipped, and then everyone was reassured. And they went on being reassured for about a month, didn't they? And it's very curious, the South Koreans for a long time, the defense minister got actually told off because I'm sure that the Navy knew all along what had happened and were sort of probably itching to say so. But for whatever reason, the South Koreans played it cool, and then they built us up to this big inquiry, and then it all came out. And then they got very angry indeed. I mean, perfectly understandable, but the question I'm trying to raise is, just as I don't really see what Kim Jong-il is up to in the long run, brilliant tactics, ran rings around Bush, but at the end of the day, where is North Korea going, where is he going, and so forth. And forgive the South Koreans here may be offended by it, I don't intend to, but no suggestion of any full equivalence, but just in terms of this strategy tactics distinction, I'm really not clear what Lee Myung-bak's been up to, because, as I say, stage one, play it very, very softly, calming the markets, everything's all right, reassure everyone. Stage two, get very angry indeed and announce that you're going to do all sorts of stuff. And stage three is retreat. And let me give you a bit of detail on that, because I'm not sure, I mean, you all journalists, you're probably all terribly well informed on this, so apologies if I do tell you stuff that you know already. Even in the thing they said they were going to do, in an atmosphere like this, said President Lee, inter-Korean exchange is meaningless. So the headline you got was all trade to be banned. Ah, but there was an exception. The Kaesong zone, the thing that would be Shenzhen, but is if Koreans on both sides were more pragmatic, but it is one little estate just north of the DMZ where about 110 small South Korean companies employ about 42,000 North Korean workers. Even in the hour of sort of being fierce and threatening the North Koreans back, the Kaesong zone was accepted. That zone accounts for more than half of inter-Korean trade. So his statement that in a time like this, exchange is meaningless, was itself meaningless, or it was itself not true. Secondly, he said, we're going to resume propaganda broadcasts along the DMZ. And I thought, why on earth are you doing that? That doesn't make South Korea any more secure. That's just completely gratuitous. The North Koreans, predictably, are of course, foaming at the mouth by this time. It's very difficult for the North Koreans. I mean, their normal language is shouting themselves hoarse. So when they want to raise their voice, it's really quite hard to know what to do. I mean, absolute verbal paroxysms and so forth. They said, if you do that, we'll shoot them out. Or more to the point, if you do that, we'll actually close the border. Now, the point about that is that, yes, the once, those of us who are old-timers probably still think of the laughingly named demilitarized zone as impermeable. Of course, it's not impermeable. Every day, several hundred South Korean managers, engineers, and so forth get up very early in Seoul and the suburbs, and they drive north, and they cross over and do their jobs in Kaesong, and they come home. And guess what? Throughout this entire crisis, including even the couple of days in late May when it all was a bit wobbly and it affected global markets, though what was Greece and what was Korea, nobody seemed to be quite sure, Kaesong never stopped. The commute never stopped. Although, because the South Koreans weren't the only ones whose bark turned out to be worse than their bite. The North Koreans said in their stern statements, we will immediately suspend all military hotlines. Now, one of those is the ones where people just do the routine stuff. Okay, how many people are coming across today? What are your names and so forth? They didn't suspend it. So when I grasped this, then I breathed again, because I was worried. I mean, you know, when things threaten to get out of control, you're not quite sure how far people are going to take this, why they will do it. You do worry, quite rightly. But it seems that even in this very difficult time, and I don't mean to underrate it, and obviously we are back to a much grimmer phase in relations between the two Koreas, there was actually some understanding about the Kaesong zone, and some North Koreans within the zone seem apparently tipped to the South Korean, firms there that they did want the thing to continue. So what happens? Those propaganda, I don't know if briefly the propaganda broadcast started up, but they stopped again. What else? There are going to be huge joint exercises in the Yellow Sea, West Sea for Koreans with the US, the vast aircraft carrier, the George Washington. These appear to have been postponed. And again, the South Koreans can't quite get their act together. Has it been just because, we're not quite ready yet, or is it to give diplomacy a chance? I think Robert Gates has now said it's to give diplomacy a chance. Oh, and even on the banning of all trade, suddenly there are exceptions. Garlic and garments made in the north for southern firms can come through and so forth. So it's all looking a bit iffy. And in among all of this, by coincidence, as you may know, the South Koreans had an election. It was only local elections. They don't count for much, but symbolically they do. It had been expected by all concerned that the ruling party would win, so-called North Wind. It's happened in the past, get people scared of North Korea and they all vote conservative. Not this time. That would be a whole other area that we probably don't have time to go into, but let's in discussion. But quite what the state of mind of your average South Korean is right now is, I think, quite a complex question. In Seoul itself, where the mayor, Oh Se-hoon, is actually quite popular and young and dynamic and Blairite, is that still an adjective of praise? Surely not, but anyway, like he used to be when some of us were terribly in love with him. Anyway, at Han Myung, a former prime minister, the only former female prime minister, ran as the peace candidate and very nearly beat him, actually. And the Democratic Party, which has been in a real mess, the center-left opposition, they were in power for the last 10 years. They did struggle and stumble a bit under the late Noh Moo-hyun. So it wasn't as if anybody thought, they didn't think they had anything going for them. And they've done extremely well in these elections. That seems to suggest that South Korean public opinion doesn't want the peace disturbed and seems to be even discounting the further shores of conspiracy theory of think it was a known goal and that sort of thing. But they're really not sure who is actually disturbing the peace. And there are also other issues about people who think that Lee Myung-bak is still too much of a bulldozer generally. That was his nickname, of course, that he's always pushing policies through. I had more, but I think my time is up. And sorry, that slightly arbitrary moment. I will leave it and thank you and ask for your questions. Thank you. Shall I come down?
Thank you very much indeed. As Aidan Foster-Carter just implied, there's a richer. There's a rich amount to be said in this particular subject, and no doubt it will come out in the questioning. If I can just ask you in the normally way to indicate who you are, and we will take it from there. Does anybody have a first question? If not, I will usurp that possibility by asking, what is your opinion about China's position in all of this? In other words, how much will China do in exerting pressure on the North, if at all?
Nothing publicly. It's obvious, isn't it? I mean, the whole, that's another of the things that, as far as I can see, Lee Myung-bak hasn't thought through. There is no, in what conceivable circumstance could he have imagined that China would dance to his tune or dance to what might be perceived as a US-South Korean tune. Now, I know that's grossly unfair. We are all believers in the scientific method, I'm sure, so if the survey was properly done, as I'm sure it was, and if the evidence is convincing, then we should all, as good empiricists, sign up to the evidence. But China doesn't work that way, does it? China is very annoyed with North Korea, there's no doubt about that. The only time they ever say so publicly is when the North Koreans test nuclear weapons. Both times, China officially criticized that. Anything else they do behind the scenes. And again, I think their reasoning is well known. I'm not supporting this. I'm just trying to judge how I see them as actually working. China doesn't like chaos. There is something worse in the Chinese imaginary than North Korea as is, and that's North Korea as isn't. That's chaos. That's the collapse situation, possibly loose nukes, and so on. South Korea, some South Koreans also see that as a very big problem. And there's a further twist, which isn't always, I mean, most of, I think, what I've just said, I fear, is banal and is much discussed, but there is a twist that seems to me to often get left out, because at one level, North Korea is everybody's problem, and in a way, the point of view that says China really should come into line on this is starting from that premise. But geopolitics and geoeconomics have not gone away. Insofar as anybody's ever going to have any influence, has a chance of any influence in Pyongyang, really it's down to South Korea and China. And again, did Lee Myung-bak think through, long before the Chonan, when he walked away from the sunshine policy, when he cancelled, and this is what annoyed the North Koreans, he cancelled the rather good deals, in my view, surprisingly good win-win deals, not one-sided deals, that the late Noh Moo-hyun had just signed up for in the October 07 summit and wasn't going to do that. Did he not realize that that was leaving a vacuum in terms of, like, who was going to invest in North Korea's mines and infrastructure? Who did he think was going to go in, not the Chinese? So you get the dear old Chosun Ilbo, the main conservative paper in Seoul, when they're not fulminating against North Korea correctly for all its badness, they are fulminating that North Korea is becoming the fourth province of Manchuria. Well, what do they expect, you know? So I think at least one of the possible futures for North Korea, and not perhaps the worst, probably after Kim Jong-il, is as a nice, quiet, pliant Chinese client state. I'll get that in the tour. No one else has managed to bring them round. Maybe you should let the Chinese have a go. I know South Koreans can't allow themselves to want that because, of course, despite 10 years of sunshine, each Korean government still claims to be the only legitimate government on that territory, south of the Yalu and the Two Men Rivers. But I think that's one possible outcome. So there's just no way the Chinese are going to do that, is there?
Colin. Colin Murphy from Lloyd's List. Thank you very much for that. I just wanted to, I hope you don't mind if I go back a little bit to the original topic, which was to do with the business
side.
Because
yes, sure.
I'm working now in the shipping industry and shipbuilding in particular, and I'm trying to understand what are some of the factors that you see that explains South Korea's success in shipbuilding. I mean, it's completely away from the original discussion earlier, but I am curious to know if you can sort of shed some light on that for me and perhaps contrast with the Japanese approach. What is it that has made South Korea so successful in recent years?
Gosh, I'm always very happy to talk about South Korea. One of the paradoxes of the present situation, I know the South Korean embassy in London got quite fed up that at places like Chatham House, the only talks on Korea that ever happen are about North Korea. It's sort of like Cain and Abel, you know. We are the virtuous Koreans. We have done great things in the world. We have developed, we have grown. And no one cares, you know. No one wants to have talks. That said, my knowledge of the shipbuilding industry isn't deep enough to know what Japan did wrong. The Korean story is fairly extraordinary, isn't it? It sort of involves the usual thing of getting technologies from people, buying them cheap, and then undercutting them like mad. But I don't have enough sectoral knowledge on that one, to be honest. I mean, they put my country out of business pretty much, and a lot of others as well. They are now at risk, of course, of the Chinese doing to them what they did with Japan. I think you start, and this is probably a story that's common, I mean, this is how the Samsungs of this world began as well, and you start lower end, don't you? I mean, so the Chinese now make the very large crude carriers, don't they? Which are presumably just very large bits of metal, basically. And then the Koreans have moved up into, I believe the Koreans specialize in most of the oil drilling, oil industry related things. And I think the one that they've left to the Italians and the French is cruise liners, and now the South Koreans are starting in that as well. Sorry, her disguises. I mean, I don't have enough sectoral knowledge beyond that. I I don't know about the psyche. And as far as shipbuilding goes, I mean, although latterly there have been some acquisitions, I mean, it's some other industries it would be more true. I mean, there was the great phrase in semiconductors of setting up in and cars, very importantly. I mean, Kia cars now made in Slovakia and stuff like that. No, I think it's seriously going for where the markets are. And one reason why Im Yong Bak, has and his government, to be given credit for something, have come very fast out of the downturn. 8% growth in the first quarter of this year is because South Korea firms within the past, direct encouragement from government, now just indirect, head for the markets and places that look difficult to other people, they go to. I mean, it could be overdone. I mean, Daewoo's huge decline and fall probably was a result of buying up every single car firm in the whole of Eastern Europe, as far as I could see it. And you wondered how they could afford to do it. But they nowadays, you know, China's a huge market for them. That's very important. India's, you know, they saw the Indian potential long before a lot of other people did. So just going and looking for the markets, I think.
Thank you. Gentleman down here.
Yeah, hi, Ben Richardson from Bloomberg. I was in South Korea last week, and one of the interesting things that I thought came out of a unification ministry briefing was there was a lot of wrong thinking among the South Korean population. The government officials said they were going to try and rectify this wrong thinking. And it just struck me that, and again, with the election results as well, there seemed to be an awful lot of young people coming out. The dissenters, the one quarter of the population don't actually agree with the findings of the survey. What is it that makes it was the government's reaction to that, because you often get young people disagreeing and dissenting with governments.
It's what young people are for.
That's right, exactly. So why is it that South government is so uncertain?
There's a lot of history, I think, behind it. I mean, let me try and be brief. There are generational issues in South Korean politics, definitely. And there are those who see all, you know, the conservative Grand National Party, the ruling party in general, as, I mean, not entirely incorrectly, as the sort of the historical heirs, H-E-I-R-S, to the military regimes. There certainly was a past in which, you know, governments do tell lies. We know that, don't we? Specifically, incidents had been engineered in the past. I mean, there was at least one occasion when the South Korean intelligence got the North Korean intelligence to stage a little show at Panmunjom to frighten everybody into voting conservative. It doesn't work anymore. So, I mean, and there have been trumped-up cases in the past. So there's this great legacy of mistrust by younger Koreans. There's also, I mean, a lot of annoyance with Lee Myung-bak. His nickname is Bulldozer. He made his career in business. For all that he was, I think, quite a successful mayor of Seoul, I don't think he really gets politics. And he just likes to sort of go ahead and do stuff and expect people to sort of follow along with him. So people may remember that quite early on, I mean, he got elected by a landslide. And okay, you may say South Korean voters are a bit volatile, maybe, but he gets elected by a landslide. Then he, saying he's been pro-American, I mean, he's certainly true to his word, he unbans American beef. I think everybody else had long since unbanned it. And there are these sort of huge protests, which I think weren't just about beef. I mean, they were sort of, again, they were quite strange things in a lot of ways, but I think the beef, so to speak, was against Lee Myung-bak pushing things. And now with this rebuff, he's going to, the other thing, he's got this four major rivers thing where he sort of, concrete is going to be poured along the banks of every river and the canals will be blasted. And the whole thing, he says, is green. And even the Catholic bishops are against it, who used to play a big political role in Korea, but it's the first time they've spoken out for ages. So the sense that he's just sort of going ahead and doing stuff. And I think that, I am a bit puzzled by some South Korean reactions. And, you know, we could have a longer discussion as to where the threat is. And I think there's a lot of denial in South Korea. I mean, I think young South Koreans ought to wake up and sort of smell the unification coffee, because it's going to be awful. It's going to be absolutely awful. The whole way of life they've known is going, you know, 23 million ignorant country cousins are going to come and stay and be really resentful all the time. It's going to be like Germany in spades. And no one is thinking about this, and the government is not preparing them for it. So, you know, it may be that I could understand the sort of South Korean conservative view that says they're not thinking straight, but, you know, there's an awful lot of work to be done of a more positive nature to deal with that.
Francis.
Francis Moriarty, FCC Board. Just following up from what you said and then a question. In 1986, I had, with a group of other journalists, a lot of meetings with West German officials at the very top of the government, in which the person in charge of West German intelligence at the time said he couldn't see reunification happening even in his grandchildren's grandchildren's lifetime. So anything can happen. My question actually goes to oddly enough, to Burma and the stories that the Burmese have nuclear ambitions of their own with the assistance of the North Koreans. The question arises whether that's with Chinese acknowledgement or direct participation. Thoughts?
I'm not probably fully on top of that story. Bertil Lindner is involved, and he's usually reliable. On the other hand, why does even the Burmese opposition take 5 years to compile a film? And I know that when sort of early versions of this came out in, I think, a Sydney paper, some people queried it. I mean, I don't doubt that the Burmese, I claim no expertise at all on Burma, but the mentality is a bit similar, you know, sort of vaguely want the rest of the world to go away. And I find plausible the suggestion that Burmese generals kind of looked at North Korea and thought, well, this is a pretty good way of, you know, stopping the pressure about various things. But as to how far they've actually got with it, and I cannot think. It's with the China thing, it's like, I've never been sure of the status of the reports that you do get from time to time that China sort of allows North, well, it must at some level allow overflying. I mean, how do the North Korean missiles get to Iran? They certainly don't go in boats that can be sort of chased under the proliferation, can't say it, proliferation security initiative. They do overfly. But the idea of North Korea as a proxy for China, I don't think so. I mean, I don't know enough about it, and I don't know if anybody does, but, and one is aware there are quite active debates about North Korea going on in the Chinese leadership. There are now sort of outspoken reform scholars who openly, scholars, you know, connected to the regime in China who openly criticize North Korea. One assumes there are others who think North Korea might be some use, but I thought the pattern of North Korea's action, particularly with the nuclear tests, is it's so rogue, even to China, that, I mean, if you want a proxy, you want them to be controllable, don't you? About Burma, I fear I just don't know enough. I mean, obviously, the ports are useful for China and so on.
Marty.
Martin Mertz here. While we're on China, I recently read an account of the Chinese ambassador to Pyongyang for 3 years. He's now, I think, in England. And he described Chinese diplomacy as an absolute stunning success, mainly because of the absence of war. But that perhaps just reflects the foreign ministry of China, which is notably the least informed and least powerful ministry in the Chinese government. And the more influential side would be the military, and their personal and professional connections with North Korea go for generations now. They're the ones to really be concerned about. What insights would you have on that side?
I think that is a very good point. And the North Korean military seems of all the sectors to be the ones that we know least about. Doubtless their links are important. I wonder whether for younger generations, the ones sort of coming up now, they matter as much. I mean, there are still, you know, all these 80-year-olds that I was talking about who presumably have their equivalent on the Chinese side, though I believe that retirement now tends to happen a bit earlier in China. These are the ones who did, you know, who fought shoulder to shoulder. Mao had a son killed in the war and so on. But whether for the younger ones that means very much, I don't know. And I would again say if you want a proxy, then the proxy has to be reliable. On the other hand, there's the business side of things. I mean, what is clearly happening is that some Chinese interests, and it's often hard to know what mix of public and private they are, but for example, investing in Rajin Port in the far northeast of North Korea, which is where China doesn't quite have a coast because they foolishly gave it up more than a century ago. A new bridge is being built across the Yalu and so on and so on. And there are rumors of sort of much larger sums, but those rumors have not been confirmed. I mean, I could see a case. I mean, if I were in the Chinese government myself, of throwing money into North Korea on the basis of a quote I rather like from the Edwardian humorist Saki, H.H. Munro, that of all the ways of killing a cat, choking it with cream should not be overlooked. And I mean, that I, my mind was the cynical justification for the sunshine policy, really, that you're sort of softening them up. And I could see why Chinese might, whichever ministry, so to speak, or various interests, including the local governments in provincial governments in northeast China, might want to sort of get their influence in there that way.
Tom.
Thank you. Tom Holland, South China Morning Post. I'm actually going to be cheeky. I've got three burning questions here. Firstly, I may be missing something here, but assuming there were orders from the top to sink a South Korean warship, what on earth is your best guess at the thinking behind that? And secondly, given your fourth province of Manchuria comment, given that a German-style reunification would mean economic devastation for South Korea, shouldn't or aren't the South Koreans actually quite happy to see Chinese influence grow in the north? And really, do they want reunification at all? And finally, if I may, what on earth was that about the roast donkey?
Okay, I'll do my best. I'll try and be as succinct as you were. The Chonan Arabic Christian Oliver, the FT's latest in an excellent line of FT correspondence and so on, had about six theories. I have two, one of which I think I share with him. I think it may have been something to do with the succession. What sense does that make? But we have a precedent and an analogy. I mean, they greeted Barack Obama last year, a US president who in principle might have talked to them, by firing a long-range missile and another nuclear test, which pretty much made it impossible for him to talk to them. And the best accounts of that seem to suggest that it was some sort of a grand firework. It's, if you have an incredibly introverted political system, they do things for themselves and for internal purposes. So maybe this is Kim Jong-un, the putative successor, or someone on his behalf saying, we're still a chip off the old block, don't underestimate us, even in, our hour of transition when we might feel vulnerable. That's one thing. The other thing is I think they really, really hate Lee Myung-bak, and they really are annoyed with him. And one of the reasons why I discount all the conspiracy theories about the Chonan and the own goal is now, as unlike in the past, South Korean conservatives have not the slightest motive to do this. The key thing about Lee Myung-bak and North Korea is he just wasn't interested. What did he want to strut the world stage? I mean, South Korea's so keen on the G20, moved heaven and earth to chair the thing, to get the meeting in Seoul in November, which suddenly doesn't look quite such a safe place as it must have looked at the time. And I just see the North Koreans as sort of saying, right, mate, we had a deal. We'd signed up state to state to these agreements. You withdraw, in effect, from one of them, which he did. We're going to show you that we're still here. I mean, it's not a very positive way of thinking, because he's not actually, of course, about to roll over and say, oh, we're really sorry, here's 500,000 tons of rice, But in terms of I said in the Telegraph, sorry, quoting myself, it may not make sense, but it makes North Korean sense. On the four provinces, well, yes, but I don't know if South Koreans can admit this to themselves. I mean, I think letting China do it would make an awful lot of sense, but whether it will go that way, I don't know. The roast donkey, now I presume this is an allusion to a certain train journey made by Kim Jong-il across Russia in, I think, 2001, when he was accompanied by a senior Russian official from the Far East, Konstantin Pulikovsky, who wrote a book about it in all the detail about the fresh lobster being flown in every day and the roast donkey, which is one of Kim Jong-il's favorites. And the Russian foreign ministry were hopping mad because they thought, oh my God, the North Koreans are going to be furious about this. Kim Jong-il loved it. It's also where we have the origins of that great quote, which I think is to be taken very seriously, when Kim Jong-il, in his cups possibly or not, says, I know I am much criticized in the world, but I think as long as people are talking about me, I am on the right track. We're talking about him, aren't we?
Adam Foster-Carter, thank you very much indeed. I'm afraid we're out of time, but we will put roast donkey on the menu for future lunches. So,
oh, thank you.
But before you go, I would like to present you in traditional style. The FCC has the most fabulous gifts, which we give to visiting speakers. This one will keep you warm on your visits to North Korea, and you'll need it.
very much indeed.